If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Hola.
Hello, this call is being translated.
Abuela, listen to what my phone can do.
Abuela, escucha lo que mi teléfono puede hacer.
Wow, ahora dime sobre tu novia nueva.
Wow, now tell me about this new girlfriend.
Huh?
Tú sabes lo que dije.
You know what I said.
Language is no longer a barrier thanks to Live Translate with Galaxy AI on Samsung Galaxy S24 Ultra. Learn more at Samsung.com. Samsung account login required. Calls must be made using the native Samsung dialer.
Ah, yes, the magnificent Trolley Sour Bright Crawler, also known as Trollicus brightolus. The worm's captivating neon color makes it an easy, gummy prey.
Trolley!
It's a surprisingly sour, invitingly chewy, staggeringly snackable species unlike anything else found on this planet.
Eat me!
Delicious. Visit Trolley.com to shop now.
Trolley, eat me!
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello and welcome to the BBC History Magazine weekly podcast. I'm Dave Musgrove, editor of the magazine, and this is the second of our November 2011 editions. Don't forget, BBC History Magazine is on sale in all good newsagents and on subscription. Our website is historyextra.com, and you can follow us at twitter.com/historyextra or facebook.com/historyextra. Coming up, we have...
No one really understands the Arctic convoys properly apart from those who took part in them.
That was Quintin Colville on the World War II Arctic convoys.
The solutions that we're adopting today, like managed retreat of seawalls, is not new. It's actually a very natural response to environmental change, and it shows that we're working with nature rather than fighting against nature.
That was Stephen Rippon on the historical landscape of Essex. So, firstly, I've been talking to Quintin Colville, curator of naval history at the National Maritime Museum in Greenwich. He has been working on a new exhibition on the Second World War Arctic convoys. I went up to the museum to find out more.
What's the background to the Arctic convoy story?
We're talking about the Second World War. More specifically, we're talking about the period 1941 to 1945, during which the Russian offensive against Germany was supplied with about 4 million tons of war materiel through ships that took part in these convoys from Britain to places like Murmansk and Archangel on the northern coast of Russia.
Okay, so quite a long period of time that we're talking about here. What sort of numbers of ships are we talking about?
We're talking about hundreds and hundreds of ships. And we're talking about an enormous effort, not simply by the Royal Navy, but also by the Merchant Marine. This is a question of scale, but it's also a question of the sheer difficulty of the operations, not just in terms of the enemy and what they faced in terms of enemy action, but the elements and the weather and the general logistical difficulties that were involved.
Okay, so the ships left from Britain, is that right? Where did they leave from generally?
They often left from Liverpool or the Clyde or Loch Ewe. They sometimes rendezvoused in Iceland. And the voyage itself took between 10 and 15 days to get to Murmansk or Archangel, depending on which route they took. But essentially that meant heading up into the Arctic Ocean, going up round the northern coast of Norway, far away, as far from the coastline as possible, because, of course, that was occupied by German forces, and then down to Russian territory to unload their cargoes.
Even to an uneducated sort like myself, that sounds like a reasonably perilous journey.
It was extraordinarily perilous. These are very difficult seas. There were mountainous waves much of the time. There are accounts that we have of the impact of the water actually stripping armour plate from the turrets of a cruiser. You can imagine the force required to do that. It's also a question of ice and cold. That we have in the museum also accounts from people who describe spray turning to ice as it flew through the air and rattling against the upper works of the ships. And you also had ice building up on all the decks, all the machinery, seizing up all the intricate bits of engineering, and potentially actually threatening ships with capsizing because of the weight of hundreds of tons of ice stuck to their upper works. And this is even before you've got to the perils of the U-boats, of air attack by German forces, and also German capital ships that were often lodged in the Norwegian fjords and threatened the British and threatened these convoys. So you're quite right, it's a context of extraordinary peril, and the casualties and losses reflect that.
You mentioned British. It wasn't just the British here involved in this. So there were other nationalities who were sending ships on these convoys?
Quite right, yes. And the naval effort itself was predominantly British, but the merchant marine effort was international, as you rightly say. There were large numbers of Norwegian vessels. By the end of the war, there was, I expect, a preponderance of American tonnage too. So we are talking about not just vessels, but a multinational crews as well.
Mm. What about the Canadians? Were they involved?
Yes, they were. Yes, yeah, Royal Canadian Navy too. Yes, and some American surface units as well.
So quite a big multinational effort of these ships heading across. What were the convoys like? How many ships in a convoy are we talking generally?
Probably in the 30s.
Right.
Generally speaking, they're not the largest, but relatively large, and would be defended by as many escorts as possible. And early in the war, that wasn't very many. And by the end of the war, you had situations often where one merchantman and one escort vessel, there was one for each. So the sophistication and the level of Royal Naval and other navies' interaction increased over the war.
Okay. How did their experience compare to the convoys in the other sea, in the Atlantic? Presumably the same idea was happening, but were there particular problems other than the conditions that they were facing?
I think if you're probably in a rough sea in the middle of the Atlantic, then the realities of life on board a convoy were relatively similar. If you can just imagine the chaos below decks, with water swilling around on the mess decks, with sailors having to sleep in their sodden clothes and probably eating cold food for weeks on end, those are realities that would have been shared by convoys in the in the Atlantic and convoys in the Arctic. But in the Arctic, you have to add an even greater threat of cold. The simple reality that these were conditions of extraordinary peril in terms of the elements. And the survivability, for instance, if your ship did go down, you really had minutes in water that very rarely rose above 4 degrees C in temperature.
So if you were sunk, presumably you were dead. Did people survive?
People did survive, yes. The Navy also had, there were also armed merchant vessels detailed to pick up survivors. And they had special survivability technologies built into them, but they were by no means immune from destruction themselves. And those vessels often did pick up survivors, and so also did the naval escort vessels, the sloops, the corvettes, the destroyers that accompanied these convoys. So it wasn't a sentence of death, but you needed to be out of the water extremely fast.
Presumably the German shipping that was hunting these convoys faced the same weather conditions.
Yes.
Did that mean that there was less of an enemy threat to the convoys than, say, in the Atlantic, or did actually the German shipping focus on these convoys just as much?
In some ways, it was less a question of German shipping, which often was kept bottled up along the Norwegian coastline, than U-boats, and also aerial attack. And what you did have in the context of the Arctic convoys were a situation where occupied Norway gave space for German airfields, which could cover huge distances out into the Arctic Ocean, which threatened British convoys and international convoys throughout the war. To some extent, convoys that took place during the winter months of complete darkness, were clearly protected from aerial assault, but they weren't immune from other threats.
What sort of things were they taking over to Russia then? What were the products involved here?
It's a huge range of goods and manufactured objects and raw materials, right the way through from aircraft, probably about 5,000 of those during the course of the war. In fact, more, perhaps 7,500 tanks, 5,000 of those. Petrol, rubber, ammunition, maybe 500 million projectiles of one sort or another. Things like radio sets. Boots, pieces of, things that you might think were less essential to the war effort, but were in fact instrumental. Things like trucks. There were tens of thousands of trucks delivered to the Russian war effort by these means. And for the Germans, this was an enormous problem. For every ship filled with these cargoes contained things that they would ultimately have to face on Russian battlefields if they didn't sink them in the Arctic Ocean. Far simpler to sink a merchant ship than to face the myriad contents of its hold on a battlefield.
So how important was the Arctic convoy story to the conclusion of the war? Is it a very big aspect to it?
It's one that's been chewed over a great deal, and as it has in some ways been obscured by ideology, by politics, by international relations. Even during the war itself, the alliance between the Allies and Russia was often uneasy, fractious, filled with suspicion and often personality clashes, and that made it difficult even at the time to look at the benefits, the actual outcome of this enormous effort. And after the war, in the context of the Cold War, the contribution made by the Allies and by the merchant marine was also to some extent obscured. But I don't think we can believe otherwise than that this quantity of war materiel was enormously important, and it may, as I was saying, be more the simpler items, the radios, the petrol, the thousands of tons of chemicals that were vital.
Did the individual Russian and Allied mariners get on okay? Do we have any evidence of interaction they had?
We have a good deal of evidence of the encounters that Allied service personnel had with their Russian colleagues when they reached places like Archangel or Murmansk. Often they were difficult and strained. There was a good deal of mutual suspicion and misunderstanding. The Allies did not necessarily comprehend the appalling conditions within which Soviet service personnel and civilians lived during that period, and were, for instance, shocked by the conditions in hospitals to which British and other nationality servicemen were treated by the Russians. They thought them extraordinarily basic. And so there were many areas in which this was a difficult relationship, but we can also see ones of friendship too. And the exhibition has a watercolour showing a Russian couple entertaining British sailors in their home. So there were clearly moments where personality overcame ideology.
Let's talk about the exhibition. Clearly, that's why we're here. We're in the beautiful confines of the National Maritime Museum here in Greenwich. Why here would you have an exhibition on the Arctic convoys?
Well, I think this museum as a home and heartland for our naval history, that in many ways the collections of the National Maritime Museum are unequaled in terms of our maritime and naval past. But this is also an extremely important moment for us to reflect on and recognise the contribution of the Arctic convoys, because it's a story that is perhaps flickeringly understood and not always remembered. There is a memorial, there's an anniversary of sorts in that it's 70 years since the first of these convoys began. But I think we're motivated by the sense that our collections can bring the story to life and the experiences of these sailors and merchant mariners too.
Is also timely as well, isn't it, in the sense that it's quite recently, as you discussed about the end of the Cold War.
Yes.
It's quite recently that the mariners involved got medals.
Quite right, yes.
So now is the time to be talking about it in that sense.
It is, and I think that is a recognition of the obscurity into which this campaign was cast by the vagaries of history, by the fact that our allies during the war rapidly became our enemies in the peace that followed. And that meant that this campaign didn't receive the recognition that it deserved, and now is an extremely important point to put that right and to recognise not just a military contribution but a cultural contribution as well, how these events have been remembered and how they've permeated various areas of fiction, of literature, for instance, and of art. And we have marvellous examples of war artists' work during the war too.
Have you had any input from surviving veterans?
There has been, yes, and I think it's certainly important to have those voices. And what we're also very pleased to be able to do is to combine that with actual objects like uniform, like mittens that were worn to protect sailors from the biting cold of the Arctic, duffel coat that they wore, and extraordinary photographs as well that actually propel us back in time and ask us to confront a situation and a way of living that is beyond comprehension for most people now.
You talked about the photos, and I've seen some of these photographs, and,
yes,
and they are remarkable, and they give they're surprisingly good quality in the sense. What struck me is who's taking these photos.
I don't know the particular the actual official photographers' names, and I'm not sure we will ever know. But they do give us a sense not only of the official war record of the Arctic convoys, the sense of sort of fighting and the appearance of conflict and battles, but they also give us a very personal dimension too, that you have scenes of rescued survivors. You also have a photograph of the ship's cat from HMS Duke of York, a battleship involved in the Arctic sphere, which I think really brings home the realities of the mess deck and the realities of everyday life. Apparently, during the Battle of North Cape, where this battleship HMS Duke of York fought and sunk the Scharnhorst, this cat is reputed to have snoozed happily and was not sort of roused until after hostilities had ceased. But perhaps that's a myth.
You've got one lovely photo of some sailors on deck wearing all their duffel coats and such like.
Yes.
And the point is that they've got massively thick socks and they have to wear yes. boots that are two sizes too large to fit the socks on. I mean that's quite an astonishing little fact to focus in on, and this is a sense of how difficult it must have been for these men to do anything on board ship when they were wearing so much stuff.
Extremely, and imagine trying to chip ice off a deck or use a steam hose to clean to remove ice from some piece of machinery. If you took your mittens off, if you touched metal with your bare hands up in the Arctic during one of these convoys, you were likely to lose the flesh on your hands. It was absolutely appallingly cold. But we also have an object which is called the Certificate of the Blue Nose, which was presented unofficially to sailors in this theatre to indicate that they'd actually passed into the Arctic Ocean, that they were now experienced in Arctic seas. It was a sort of crossing of the line equivalent ceremony that signed by King Neptune.
Okay. Is there any one particular object or artifact or document that you're particularly excited about being able to show to the public?
Well, I think I'd have to go with personal ones. For me, it's actually the mittens and the uniform and the duffel coat. I just think they bring you very close to the actual experiences of life on these convoys. And I'd put next to that actually a painting that will be in the exhibition by a war artist called William Dring. That shows a lieutenant commander called Harry Hall in all of his sort of Arctic kit, just sort of wrapped up to the neck. And it's believed that it was painted in 1942 when he was on board an escort vessel which was allocated to a convoy called PQ-17, which was a disastrous convoy in which only 11, I think, out of 35 vessels came through and the rest were sunk. So that for me is a particularly memorable painting.
Okay, last question. In your research for putting together this exhibition, has your knowledge been in any way advanced about this? Have we learned anything particularly new or trenchant about the story of the Arctic convoys?
I think perhaps what we've learned is that no one really understands the Arctic convoys properly apart from those who took part in them. It's easy to say that this is just a process of uncovering for historians, but it isn't actually possible ultimately to recreate the experiences of a past like this. We hope to open that up to people, to give them some points of reference, to make something that is perhaps very distant and very incomprehensible a bit more real. But we know that that's not ultimately within our gift.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
We don't always realize just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger. Talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/historyextra.
Hola.
Hello, this call is being translated.
Abuela, listen to what my phone can do.
Abuela, escucha lo que mi teléfono puede hacer.
Wow, ahora dime sobre tu novia nueva.
Wow, now tell me about this new girlfriend.
Huh?
Tú sabes lo que dije.
You know what I said.
Language is no longer a barrier thanks to Live Translate with Galaxy AI on Samsung Galaxy S24 Ultra. Learn more at Samsung.com. Samsung account login required. Calls must be made using the native Samsung dialer.
Arctic Convoys 1941-45 is on at the National Maritime Museum in Greenwich now and until 28 February 2012. Go to nmm.ac.uk for more information and have a look at our website, historyextra.com/convoy, where you can see a slideshow gallery of convoy images, including some of the photographs that we discussed in the interview. Of course, on the wartime theme, it's Remembrance Sunday this weekend, and UK listeners can watch coverage of events from the Cenotaph on BBC One on Sunday morning. I'll also be watching the Time Watch documentary on wartime double agent Eddie Chapman on BBC Two on Tuesday, 15 November at 9 p.m. I might even tweet about it as well. Now we have a short advertisement.
Discover a unique treasure trove of medieval and Renaissance manuscripts assembled by English kings and queens between the 9th and 16th centuries. See these treasures for yourself in the British Library's exhibition Royal Manuscripts, The Genius of Illumination, which runs until the 13th of March 2012. These manuscripts are now our best surviving link to this lost world, and the exhibition features stunning examples which are works of art in their own right, and as a collection, unlock the secrets of the private lives and public personae of the royals throughout the Middle Ages. Highlights include The Book of Hours, made for Margaret Beauchamp, who was a great-grandmother of Henry VIII. The Shrewsbury Book, a wedding gift for Margaret of Anjou and Henry VI in 1445, and Henry VIII's velvet-bound Psalter. For more information and to book tickets, visit the British Library website, www.bl.uk/royal.
Next up, Professor Stephen Rippon is a landscape historian at the University of Exeter. One of his projects is an exploration of the wetland environment of the South Essex marshes. I asked him a little more about the project, and the first question I put to him was, why do the South Essex marshes matter?
Well, the South Essex Marshes is an area of about 1,500 hectares. In southern Essex, the largest area that's best known is Canvey Island. And it's within an area east of London that's been identified as part of what's called the Thames Gateway Initiative, which is a big urban regeneration initiative. And the Royal Society for Protection of Birds are trying to create a new nature reserve, which obviously is trying to enhance the nature conservation interest of the area, but also increase public access to the countryside.
OK, and why is this place archaeologically interesting? Why is a man like you investigating this place?
Well, most British sort of wetlands were reclaimed in the medieval period. So a seawall, an embankment was built along the coast, and a network of ditches were dug to drain the landscape and use it quite intensively for arable farming. What's interesting about the South Essex marshes is that over the course of the medieval period, they weren't reclaimed and they were just left as a sort of a natural salt marsh environment where they were grazed by sheep. And the reclamation actually came much, much later. And so this is a wonderfully well-preserved sort of traditional grazing marsh that hasn't really been destroyed by the ravages of modern farming, modern urban and industrial development.
OK, so why were medieval people interested in winning land from the sea, and how successful were they in getting it back, particularly in the South Essex marshes?
In the medieval period, the economy was driven by agriculture. some industry, but we were essentially an agricultural society. And so reclamation was one way of increasing the agricultural productivity of land. A salt marsh, in other words, wetlands in their natural state, can't really be used for growing crops. And if you do have livestock on them, they're vulnerable to loss through freak floods. If you construct an embankment, if you then drain the land, you stop the salt water from contaminating the soils, and you can very productively grow crops like arable crops like wheat and barley, and you can sell them at a market and you can make a profit. So around most of Britain, that was the way that medieval communities used wetlands. The issue in the South Essex marshes, and the reason why in the medieval period there was very little reclamation, was that the South Essex marshes are very close to London, which provided an enormous market for fresh dairy produce like butter and cheese and milk. So what landowners seemed to have worked out was that they could leave the marshes unreclaimed, they could graze their livestock, make dairy produce and sell it in London for profit. And that profit was higher than they would have achieved through embanking the land and then just growing arable crops.
Okay. So have you been able to find much evidence for what medieval people were doing in the South Essex marshes then, if as you're saying, it's presumably fairly ephemeral, the evidence for grazing animals?
I mean, some of the most interesting evidence is actually in the place names. In that even today, in the South Essex marshes, there's a series of places that are called Wick. And the place name Wick, in the context of coastal marshes, refers to small, often raised areas where there would have been maybe a shepherd's hut and a place that they would have milked the livestock. So it's like small little dairies. And these Wicks were then retained following reclamation in the post-medieval period as the sites of farms. So if you look on old maps of the area, most of the farms are actually called Wicks, which actually, if you like, harks back to the pre-reclamation period when these salt marshes were just grazed by primarily sheep that would have been milked at these small dairies, which were the Wicks.
OK, so you can really make use of the place name evidence to construct that medieval landscape.
Yeah, yeah.
There comes a time when the marshes were properly won back from the sea, though. When does that happen? How does that venture take place?
The large-scale reclamation was actually as late as the early 17th century, when there was great agricultural prosperity in Britain. There was great investment in land. And what we see is that local landowners came together and they actually paid some Dutch engineers to embank a lot of the marshes. And the work we've done has actually been able to identify a very distinctive form of seawall, which we're fairly certain are survivals from this early 17th century Dutch embankment. And quite a number of these Dutch seawalls still actually survive today. Some of them have got public footpaths along them, so you can actually still go and visit them today.
It's curious, this sort of the Anglo-Dutch connection there. Presumably people were interested in Dutch engineers because in the Low Countries they had a lot of similar problems. And were they better at draining land in Holland and in the Low Countries than over here in England and Britain?
Yes. I mean, the people in the Low Countries were very skilled at water engineering, but they were also actually very entrepreneurial. And even if you go back into the medieval period, there were actually Dutchmen and Flemings who, it's well documented, were colonisers of new land, both in mainland Europe and for example, in Pembrokeshire in the 12th century. When the Normans invaded Wales, it's documented that they actually brought people from the Low Countries to help colonise the newly conquered land. So people from the Low Country have a long history, actually, of being both very entrepreneurial, but also very, very skilled engineers.
OK. So how successful were those later Dutch-led embankments then? Did they, are they what we still have now? Is that the extent of the reclamation?
It looks like most of the marshes were reclaimed by the Dutch, but in some places, and particularly facing onto the Thames estuary, if you look at the seawalls, they're actually very different in their character to what we think of the Dutch seawalls that survive. And also, we can see by analysing the landscape that these seawalls along the banks of the Thames are actually superimposed upon earlier fields. And it's very clear that these seawalls have been set back to their present location, and that the seawalls used to be further out into what is now the Thames estuary. In other words, they've been set back to their present location, we think, in the late 18th and the early 19th centuries.
So what's going on? Why would that have happened?
It's almost certainly to do with environmental change, rising sea levels, and also perhaps changing tidal conditions that are leading to erosion. Thames estuary is getting wider and wider over time. And this means that the sea walls are being undermined. And rather than trying to maintain sea walls in their present location, people have decided, look, let's give up. Let's simply move the seawall further inland, which means that hundreds of square metres of land have actually been lost.
So that's interesting, because there's clearly a modern parallel with that in what's happening today. There's often a policy of letting the sea win back and coastal erosion happen. So have we got a precedent for that policy?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a wonderful example of how studying the past means that you can actually understand how human communities have interacted with the environment. And what we see is that the solutions that we're adopting today, like managed retreat of seawalls, is not new. It's actually a very natural response to environmental change. And it shows that we're working with nature rather than fighting against nature. And it might be that within 100 years, conditions have changed and salt marshes are actually starting to form again in front of our sea walls. So it's quite a sort of a cyclical process. But I just think it reflects how sort of modern engineers are actually following historical patterns and doing something that's actually quite natural.
Now, you were telling me before we start our interview that there's some interesting connections between these lowland wetland areas and the upland communities. Can you tell me a bit about that?
Yeah, the historical record shows that areas of these marshes weren't occupied by a single parish, but they used to be divided up into relatively small parcels that belonged to parishes in adjacent and sometimes quite distant areas of southern Essex. Now, from my perspective as a landscape historian, that's very interesting in that it suggests that the marshes used to be a large area of common land in which all the neighbouring communities could take their livestock in the summer to graze them on the marshes. So the marshes didn't used to belong to any one community. They were a large area of common. But over time, as population was increasing, there was a desire to define property rights. And so what we see is that inland parishes had little detached parcels down on the marshes.
Okay.
So historically, that's very interesting. When I was doing my research with the RSPB and making presentations to various other planners and countryside managers, they were really interested in this, partly because of the history of the landscape, but also as a way of promoting the nature reserve to often quite distant communities, some of which now are largely urban, and using this as a way of saying to these communities, look, come and visit the nature reserve, because your communities used to own this land back in the medieval period. And communities living where you are now used to drive their livestock, their flocks of sheep, down lanes that you can still walk down onto the marshes. So what we're hoping is sort of using our historical understanding of the landscape to actually promote increased public engagement and access to the countryside.
And do you think it'll work? Do you see droves of people from Basildon charging down to their former chunk of land in the marshes?
Well, we hope so. Current RSPB reserves, and there's also a country park, gets over 100,000 visitors. And as the RSPB develop their reserves in the area, they're hoping for maybe 300,000 visitors. A lot of these will be going there to see the natural heritage of the area, most obviously the very, very rich bird life. But what we're hoping is that people will also be interested in the remarkable history of the landscape, and in particular this really well-preserved suite of historical features like these wonderful 17th century Dutch sea walls.
Stephen Rippon is an archaeologist at the University of Exeter. His research project on the marshes was funded by the Arts and Humanities Research Council. That's all for this week's episode. I hope you've enjoyed it. Next time we'll be hearing from some Second World War veterans. BBC History Magazine's weekly podcast is recorded in Bristol and produced by the remarkable Dave Gibson. Thank you.